The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Good morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway. Good Wednesday to you. I want to thank in advance Ed Morrissey, who will be sitting in for me tomorrow as I've got to go down to Miami for the day. But Ed will be bringing us all the latest news from Texas. So it'll just be twangy. But that's it, just twangy. A lot of news last night. Bernie Moreno will be the Republican nominee against Sherrod Brown in the fall. He should beat Sherrod Brown. Bernie Moreno is a very charismatic fellow, immigrant from Colombia, great success story, car dealer, wonderful guy, a lot of charisma, a lot of sparkle. As I have told everyone, when I moderated a debate 2 years ago that had J.D. Vance and Bernie and Matt Dolan and a bunch of other people, Josh Mandel, I think there were six candidates, I just came away impressed with Bernie Moreno. A lot of sparkle. Very close race with Matt Dolan, another good American. But Bernie should beat Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown graduated from Yale in 1974. I don't think he's ever had a job other than being paid by the government to hold office. State House. Then Congress, then 18 years in the Senate. It's time for Sherrod Brown to go home. He's 71 years old. Seriously, he's been in. It's like Joe Biden for Ohio. And Ohio has changed significantly. Ohio is a red state. Bernie Moreno is your guy. Go and maybe help him out with a few bucks. He won. He won big and good for him. It was a hard-fought campaign. Bernie was endorsed by former President Trump and by J.D. Vance. Matt Dolan was endorsed by Governor DeWine and Rob Portman. Turns out Ohio's much redder than we thought, and it is a Trump state, and Bernie is going to be the next senator. By the way, billionaire John Paulson is holding a mega donor fundraiser for Donald Trump. The money's starting to come in. Chuck Schumer had a call yesterday with Jewish leaders in America to apologize and backpedal. Ain't going to work. The U.S. is going to send, Israel is sending a delegation to hear all of America's great ideas on how they don't have to take Rafah. They should. I agree with John Podhoretz. They should go into Rafah right now. And I can't begin to tell you what's going on the border in Texas, because the Supreme Court said Texas law can take effect, and then last night the Fifth Circuit enjoined it. So I don't know what's going on, but I do know that yesterday General McKenzie and General Milley. Now, General Milley was the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff during the Afghanistan evacuation. General McKenzie was the combatant commander of Central Command. They testified yesterday at a House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing, and it was quite remarkable. Let's start with General McKenzie, since he had actual chain of command control over the evacuation. Cut number one.
Much of my testimony will of necessity mirror that earlier transcribed testimony. As a theater commander, I will confine my opening remarks to those matters that were under my direct operational control, specifically the withdrawal of U.S. military forces and the subsequent non-combatant evacuation operation, or NEO. These were two distinct and separate operations. We had detailed, constantly updated plans for each of them. We executed both of those plans, although separated in time. And thanks to the valor and dedication of thousands of men and women in harm's way, we completed both missions, but not without loss of life. We honor the 13 brave Americans who died at Abbey Gate, joining the over 2,400 other service members who lost their lives in this 20-year campaign. Their sacrifice stands with those of our coalition partners and, of course, the Afghans who fought beside us for so many years. I briefed President Trump on a plan to completely depart Afghanistan on 3 June 2020. This plan envisioned the complete withdrawal of all our forces and our diplomats and citizens. It also contemplated the possible withdrawal of Afghans who had served with us. The plan had a number of options, but it was the framework for everything that followed. Ultimately, President Trump selected a branch of the plan that maintained 2,500 U.S. military personnel in Afghanistan by Inauguration Day in January 2021. We had branches to that plan to complete a withdrawal by May of 2021 had we been so ordered. On 11 April 2021, I received orders from President Biden through the Secretary of Defense to execute a full military withdrawal by 11 September 2021, a date which was subsequently modified to the end of August. This decision did not include the withdrawal of our embassy, our citizens, and at-risk Afghans.
Thank you very much. Joe Biden made the call. Joe Biden screwed it up. Joe Biden did not use any of the plans that were in place. Donald Trump was going to leave 2,500 troops. NATO was going to leave 2,500 troops. Afghanistan would still be free if that had happened. Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, also testified yesterday. Cut number two.
I asked Secretary of State Blinken on September of 2021 about the infamous phone call with Ghani. And Reuters did get a copy of that phone call, about the transcript and apparently an actual verbatim. They listened to it. And in it, he said that there's a need, whether it's true or not, this is our president of the United States saying this, whether it's true or not, there's a need to project a different picture about the Taliban's capabilities. General McKenzie, you talked about how there was no plan to get U.S. citizens out. And then there seemed to be a bewilderment on the part of the administration why Americans weren't flocking to leave. They didn't have many ways of doing it anyway. And I'm just wondering what you thought of that phone call. I mean, I asked Blinken. He said, you know, I don't talk about something that's been leaked. Well, is it true? Did he say that? You know, lying like that to me, when you give the false impression to a whole group of Americans who never then got out, that's very, very serious. Secondly, just let me ask, because I will run out of time, how many Americans were left behind? And again, I thank you that you did everything you could to make this policy work, but you were given a policy that was egregiously flawed. But how many Americans are left behind? How many of our allies? And what has happened to them? Have they been beaten, killed, tortured? And secondly, about all the weapons that were left behind, there are reports that some of it has found its way to Hamas. I don't know if that's true. I know you did everything you could on the way out to destroy them, but many were intact and left in the hands of the Taliban.
I can't speak to the phone call. I don't have any personal knowledge of that. Number of Americans. This was always an issue. The number of Americans, as General McKenzie said, an F-77 report is supposed to, every ambassador in every country of the world keeps an F-77 report, and they're supposed to track the Americans, where they're at, the phone numbers, address, et cetera, in the country. That was always a difficult number for us in the Department of Defense to get a hold of, and I think it's true at the tactical level and operational level as well. And I'll be candid. I don't know the exact number of Americans that were left behind because the starting number was never clear. Same is true of at-risk Afghans, SIVs, the commandos, other Afghans that serve with us. Those numbers varied so widely that they were quite inaccurate, as best I could tell at the time. So I would just say I'm not sure, even today, about the accuracy of all those numbers.
Are they in jail, dead, some of them?
I think some were killed, Afghans. I don't know about the Americans. I don't think the Americans were. But I think some of the Afghans were tracked down that worked with us. And I think some of them were killed, and I'm pretty certain some of them in pretty brutal ways. Some were managed to escape through various means. Others are just laid low and keeping their heads down.
I think that General Milley and General McKenzie did a fine job yesterday. If you watched any of this, not one Democrat came to the hearing. All Republicans, not one Democrat. Here's General Milley again and General McKenzie talking about what happened there. Cut number four.
It's one thing to have the plan. It's the second thing to do the actual coordination on the plan, to talk about the specifics of execution. So having a plan is one thing, preparing the plan, vetting the plan, coordinating the plan with the people that are going to actually carry you out, the Department of Defense, that's another set of tasks completely.
And that was too little, too late.
It was my judgment that it was far too little, far too late.
Was that your assessment, General Milley?
It was.
Too little, far too late. General McKenzie on the State Department, cut number five.
I was concerned about the different pace of Department of Defense planning as compared to Department of State planning. And I took an opportunity then to make representations to the Secretary about my concern over that, the fact that we were moving pretty fast on this. They were not moving fast, and I was concerned that we were going to arrive at different locations just based on it. And I went to the Secretary. We spent some time talking about that, and actually followed up with a written idea on some things that we could do. Sent a letter with 10 recommendations to the Secretary of Defense on that.
A surprise. State screwed it up. What a surprise. But don't worry, Joe Biden's in charge. President Biden yesterday in Reno, cut number 6.
You've united Europe in a way. You've increased NATO and the border of NATO from bringing in Sweden and Norway. And he says it's changed the world.
Stop for a second. Norway is a founding member of NATO from 1949 forward. We brought in Sweden and Finland this year. But don't worry about Joe Biden. He's on top of everything. You got nothing to worry about, America. He's on top of everything. Absolutely on top of everything. He's not lost at all. There's a lot to do today, and I'm going to cover it all, including Christine Rosen has a new piece in Commentary, The Elite War on the American Middle Class and How to End It. We'll talk about that when I get back. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway on the Salem News Channel, the Salem Radio Network, and all of our wonderful affiliates. Joined this morning by Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Morning, Hugh. Hope you're doing well.
I am, and I hope you are as well. I am curious about a lot of things, but I want to start with a very quick political question. Since the middle of December, there have been a half dozen polls of Wisconsin in the 2024 presidential election. Donald Trump is ahead of 5 of 6 of them, and he's tied in the 6th. How come he's leading in Wisconsin, but we kind of lost Wisconsin in the Supreme Court race?
Well, in the Supreme Court race, the primary issue is abortion. And the left was able to very easily generate a lot of attention in Madison and Milwaukee, and they turned out the vote big time. We actually got 200,000 more votes for our conservative judge candidate. Did a pretty good job getting our base out for that spring election. These occur in April. But the left just did so much better because they only have to concentrate on two areas. We've got to get votes from throughout the state. It's a much more difficult task, and that's true in most states, right? You've got these big blue metropolitan areas. It's a lot easier to get the voter turnout there than it is trying to go to every little town and municipality throughout the state and the rural areas and get the same number of votes. So abortion was a big issue.
4 years ago, the ABC Washington Post poll the week before the election said that Joe Biden was going to win the state by double digits, maybe, I think, 17 points. And it was less than a half a point. So I don't know what to believe in Wisconsin. What do you think is going to happen there in the rematch?
Well, listen, I think people are disgusted with Democrat governance, what Joe Biden is doing to this country. So I hope enough Wisconsinites are awake to that. But in the end, it all gets down to that grassroots effort. Are we going to turn out the vote? And we've embraced early voting. We're going to be encouraging, Republicans to vote absentee, vote early, go into the clerk's office, get your vote done so that our voting turnout operation on election day, we don't have to concentrate on those people. We can concentrate on the people that haven't voted. So Democrats have been great at doing this. I mean, we all mocked Obama about being a community organizer. Well, that community organization has kicked our butts a couple times and quite a few times in elections. We need to mimic what the left does from that standpoint.
I know I want to talk about the spending bill. I very rarely talk about shutdowns and threatened shutdowns because they're always threatened and they never happen. There's another minibus coming along, I think another half dozen to 8 different major appropriations bills bundled together. What does that look like to you, Senator Johnson? Is that going to pass? Do we have to worry about a shutdown?
No, I mean, the fix is in. What's disappointing to me is they're loaded up with earmarks again. And again, as a percentage of the bill, it's not that large a percent, but it's, as Tom Coburn used to say, it literally is the gateway drug to massive deficit spending. So, it's always been, since I got here, it's been the Republican Senate conference position to be against earmarks until it wasn't. Every Congress, we hold a conference meeting, we pass resolutions to be opposed to earmarks. Now there's debate. There's legitimate points on both sides, but in general, we've taken the Coburn view that this is a gateway drug and we're just going to not participate in earmarks until I think the omnibus for in December 2022, all of a sudden, what? We had a bunch of Republicans now they're requesting earmarks and then voting for them, and we're going to get the same thing. In the last, the minibus, we had, I think, 600 pages worth, 6,000 earmarks, filling $12 billion. I'm expecting to see something every bit as gross.
But is it going to get through? My question is, I don't think there's any upside in a shutdown when we don't control the Senate.
No, we'll pass.
Yeah. Okay, so we're not going to have a shutdown. Talk to me a little bit about Chuck Schumer and his lecturing Israel on how they ought to conduct their democracy. Did Leader McConnell went down there and rebuked him, but have other members rebuked him privately? That was really an outrageous intervention in another sovereign state, democratic state's politics.
I agree. And I think I agree with that. I think McConnell did a good job being down on the floor and publicly rebuking. I'm not so sure there's private rebuke. I do appreciate what's happening throughout in many places in the media where people are really questioning what Schumer did there. But again, Democrats are in a tough place here. They realize that they've got their identity politics and they can't upset any group within that base. And, you know, their Arab supporters are pretty ticked off at them about the support for Israel. So now they're not supporting Israel. That's the problem with identity politics, I guess. You know, rather than having real principles, all you're really interested in is votes and power.
Well, Jewish American voters went by 80-20 for Al Gore in the year 2000, but Joe Biden has lost 10% of that. He's down to 68%. And I think it's going to drop further, Senator Johnson. Don't you, supporters of Israel, Jewish Americans and non-Jewish Americans support Israel? I just don't think they can vote Democratic.
Well, I hope they don't. And not only just because of the hypocritical support for the state of Israel that Biden is displaying here. Well, you know, how about the open borders that are clear and present danger to this nation? How about the massive deficit spending that sparked 40-year high inflation, made your dollar at the start of the Biden administration now worth 85 cents? I mean, I hope Jewish Americans take a look at the bigger picture here and realize the Democrat governance has been a disaster for this country.
Did you go to the State of the Union, Senator Ron Johnson?
I did not. I watched it on TV.
Okay. I was wondering what it's like to be yelled at for an hour, because it was really odd.
Well, I was yelled at over the TV like the rest of America was, from a bitter, angry old man who just can't understand that, all the wonderful things he thinks he's doing for this country are destroying it, and more Americans are recognizing that fact.
Well, 38% approval is a record low for an incumbent president seeking re-election, and it was a doomsday for Jimmy Carter, Donald Trump, and George H.W. Bush. Can you imagine him? I just can't imagine him winning again. Do you think they'll swap him out?
That's always what I believed. But I tell you, I think after the State of the Union, whatever they hopped him up on, he proved he was energetic enough, I guess, that he doesn't want to go away. And it's going to be difficult if he's not willing to step aside to push him aside. And then who do they put in his place? I mean, that would be an interesting fight to watch. I'm becoming more and more convinced that he actually would be their candidate.
You know, when I see him bobbling along over to Marine One, I'm not so sure, Senator Johnson. But let me turn to a different subject entirely, which is the open border. In terms of the Jim Lankford, a friend of the show and a friend of mine, I think he did as best he could. But they would not build the wall. Is that why it died in conference? They would not build the wall?
No, I think the main problem wasn't the 5,000 per day threshold, which made it mandatory to stop processing asylum claims and send people back. It was the 4,000 daily average threshold that made it discretionary. And Hugh, the reason that was a problem is that the Supreme Court ruled that the president, the current law exudes deference to the president. And so Trump had the authority. I mean, it's been weakened by court decisions, but even that weakened authority, Trump used to secure the border. Biden used that same authority to open it up. So he had the authority. By putting in that 4,000 discretionary threshold, you're basically saying Congress does not believe the president has the authority. So people use that in courts, and then that authority went away in three years. So that bill actually weakened a serious president's authority to close the border. That's, to me, why it was just dead on arrival in my mind.
Well, I thought it was DOA because I'm just an ordinary American. I don't get into the specifics of immigration law. I want the wall finished because it is the visible manifestation of an inward resolve to control the border. And this has happened three times. I've been doing this show for 24 years. This is the third time immigration reform crashed and burned. And until and unless you put a wall in there, it's never going to get past the base. I mean, isn't that what you hear, Senator?
Yeah, I mean, again, a wall is just table stakes. Obviously, they work. It was so stupid for Biden to stop building, finishing construction on the wall that it cost us more not to build it than to just complete it. So again, every Democrat supported that, which means every Democrat in Congress that voted that way, they actually want an open border. And that was the problem. That's what Lankford was up against. He was negotiating with people that didn't want to close the border. They were just looking for political cover. And unfortunately, the secret negotiations and what ended up being what I considered an awful bill gave that political cover.
You know, I've never heard that phrase before, and I like it. The wall is table stakes. And for the benefit of the Steelers fans, Senator Johnson, that means we don't get started until we agree on the wall, right?
Yeah, again, it is table stakes. I'm glad you like that term.
I do. I'm going to steal it from you. I'm going to, you know, claim credit for it, Senator Ron Johnson. That's what happens in the radio world, like comedy. But table stakes, the wall is table stakes. Ron Johnson, good to talk to you again, Senator. Keep coming back. Bernie Moreno won last night. I hope you come down to Ohio and help him win, beat Sherrod Brown. I know you must get along with Sherrod.
Yeah, I like to see that. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Be well. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back. We've got Senator Tom Cotton coming up. We got Mike Gallagher coming up. It's Wisconsin Day. I guess I should have cheese during the break. The fact of the matter is we like talking to our friends from the way north. They have to come down to Virginia to experience anything like spring here. I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I also want to encourage all of you to go to Alliance Defending Freedom. You can go to Alliance Defending Freedom anytime you want, but I want you to contribute to it via the banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. I played David Block last hour. I'm going to play it again. This is a Vermont snowboarding coach who got fired. Well, let him tell you about it. Here's David Block.
Two of my players and I were sitting together at a table. The conversation turned to whether male athletes should compete against female athletes. I said that even though I recognize that people may express themselves, what matters most when it comes to sports is the very real differences between the sexes. I was accused of violating the district's harassment, hazing, and bullying policy. That's censorship, and it violates the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech. That's why, with the help of Alliance Defending Freedom, I filed a lawsuit.
David Block is exactly right, and you can help Alliance Defending Freedom. You can call them at 855-374-4123, 855-374-4123, or just visit HughHewitt.com. That issue, by the way, is part of the Christine Rosen piece that I'm going to talk about next hour, the elite war on America's middle class. Coming back with Congressman Mike Gallagher and the barbershop incident. Yes, the barbershop incident. We'll tell you about it when I return to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I have to reveal a little bit of investigative reporting this morning. Congressman Mike Gallagher is my guest, as he is most Wednesdays. Good morning, Congressman. I hate to break this to you, because the great barbershop scandal involves your staff. I leave my radio show 9 a.m. on Monday morning, and I take my time. I get dressed. I go out. I walk down to the local neighborhood barbershop. It's now 9:45, and I sit down, and the only other guy in there is Eric the Red. And let's put a picture of Eric the Red up there. And Eric the Red is sitting in the seat next to me. And this guy has got a beard that goes on forever. And so I don't want to talk to him because it's kind of scary. But midway through my very quick haircut, because I keep it nice and trim, Eric the Red says to me, I work for Mike Gallagher, so I should introduce myself. I said, it's 9:45. What are you doing here on a Monday? He said, well, we don't really go to work in the Gallagher office. So I just want to let you know that the people of Wisconsin need to know that your team is in the barbershop Monday at 9:45.
Well, I assume this was my chief of staff, Taylor Andre.
That would be correct.
He has refused to shave his beard for the over 5 years we've worked together. It scares constituents. It scares small children. It's unsanitary.
Older talk show host.
It's the reason we have mice.
Look at that.
Yeah.
You sit down next to that in the barbershop, you're worried if the guy's going to come at you.
Well, honestly, I wouldn't have a problem with him going to the barbershop at 10 a.m. on a workday if he was getting his beard shaved, but well, it appears just kind of.
Moreover, he did not do full disclosure for me. He did not. I said, well, where'd you go to school? And he said, I'm a Wake Forest Demon Deacon. I was unaware that was a degree granting institution, but I looked him up when I got home to make sure I wasn't being lied to. He went to Denison first, so he went to Ohio, and Ohio expelled him, Congressman. Did you know that?
Yeah, I think he got kicked out, probably for some drinking incident,
something,
and unruly behavior. He was literally
Denison's a fine school if you like tea. They're a T-fingered school, and Wake Forest is a pretty good school, too, if you don't mind losing every game you ever play in the ACC. It's a fine place to go to school. So, Congressman, he also told me he's now buying his kids Packers gear. So I just want to know, is that a requirement of the Gallagher office?
It is. It is. It is. Taylor has a son who's very cute. And this child didn't really have any meaningful sports allegiances, so I took it upon myself to force him to become a Packers fan. And that's the only bright spot out of this whole
scenario. I actually think that's a hostile work environment. I believe that. Now, I want to get to a story that I was reading yesterday. I was downtown having lunch with a couple of people, and I read a story in the Washington Post, The Five Lies About TikTok. I really couldn't believe it. It was a pure propaganda piece. Is TikTok owned by the CCP? No, it's not. It's owned by ByteDance, which is a privately held company with three Americans on the board. What is going on with this? This should have already passed.
What's going on, Hugh, is really an unprecedented lobbying effort. TikTok has about seven different lobbying firms on retainer. They spent $500,000 just in the final quarter of last year alone on lobbying, and they're doing everything they can to spread lies about the bill. If you just look at what they pushed in the pop-up ad that they forced on all of their users when the bill was going through the House of Representatives, it was filled with lies about the bill. They're calling it an outright ban. That is, of course, not true. What we're trying to force is a divestiture. That is what we're after. But to say that China does not, the Chinese Communist Party more specifically, does not control TikTok just misunderstands the reality of how the economy works in China. There is no such thing as a private company in China. And particularly when you're talking about national champions like ByteDance, they are beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. You have CCP officials that are embedded in the corporate governance structure of ByteDance. So this is just the latest in a series of lies by TikTok. They do not want to admit reality. The CEO was not truthful when he testified before Congress. I am urging my colleagues in the Senate to take up this bill. It passed with 352 votes in the House of Representatives. The White House has signaled that they will sign the bill if and when it passes the Senate. But we can't afford to allow this to linger, particularly as we get closer to an election. The unclassified director of National Intelligence Assessment has already said, this is unclassified, that TikTok is being used by the People's Republic of China to meddle in American elections.
We saw that in real time after the attack in Israel. We saw that in real time. The TikTok algorithm loaded up pro-Hamas propaganda and put it everywhere in the United States. They also got people to replay the Osama bin Laden video from decades ago. It's really a terrible. Where is it in the Senate, though? Why hasn't it already been voted on? When something passes the House of Representatives with 350 votes, it's not really going out on a limb to support the thing.
Well, Chuck Schumer could put it on the appropriations bills that are moving this week. I would love to see that happen. Otherwise, it'll get referred to the Commerce Committee in the Senate. The chairwoman is Senator Cantwell, and the ranking member is Senator Cruz. So we're hoping to work with them, if it doesn't get attached to the appropriations bill, work with them on a path forward through the committee and ultimately through the Senate. Talk about not working on a weekday. You know, Hugh, it's hard to get the Senate to do everything. But luckily, we have members like Tom Cotton, who are sounding the alarm, who have been very vocal in urging Leader Schumer to put this bill on the floor of the Senate. I get that anything moving through the Senate cuts, you know, into the time, the limited time they have necessary. But this is an opportunity to do something that's fundamentally bipartisan, that has the overwhelming support of the House, and that the White House is ready to sign.
You know, Congressman Gallagher, if we can't do this, I don't know what we can do about the CCP. In other words, this one is so obvious. This is such an easy win. This is such a pinata because TikTok has been TikTok for a long time. It is destructive of people's lives. It is a suck on your data. I won't go near it. I don't even like to have my phone near a phone with TikTok on it. But if we can't do this, what else do you think we can do vis-a-vis the CCP?
This is a basic test of how resilient our republic is from our communist adversary. To your point, Hugh, I mean, a Chinese company couldn't buy your radio station. They couldn't buy Fox News. We have well-established precedent regarding foreign adversary ownership when it comes to traditional media. Given the fact that TikTok is increasingly the go-to news source for Americans under the age of 30, same precedent should apply in this case. And as for any concerns about the First Amendment or free speech, you are a vaunted constitutional lawyer, Hugh. You can push back if I'm wrong, but this bill doesn't say anything with respect to content or speech. We're talking about foreign adversary ownership of a social media application. And if the ownership changes, people can continue to post whatever they want on social media. Now, then we'll have a separate debate, which is a debate that all parents should have about social media in general, whether it's an American-owned company or a Chinese-owned company, and the correlation between social media use and anxiety, depression, and suicide. But that is not what this bill addresses. This bill addresses the fact that our foremost adversary now has control over what is the dominant news platform for Americans under the age of 30. That is crazy to allow that to continue. And if we allow it to continue, that's national self-suicide and basically us surrendering in the early stages of the new Cold War.
Chairman Gallagher, I don't know if you've seen John Haidt's new book, The Anxious Generation, which I've been reading this week. I brought it back on the plane with me. John Haidt is a man of the left. He writes for The Atlantic. He's an extraordinary scholar, though. And what we have done or not done for Americans under the age of 30 is basically abandon the field of their attention span and their content delivery mechanism to a market about which older Americans like me, boomers, and even middle-aged Americans like you, and that's what you are now, you have no idea what's going on in the lives of young people, and TikTok is what's going on in the lives of young people, and it's a disaster.
Well, I think Jonathan Haidt has written the best book of the last 10 years in his previous book, The Coddling of the American Mind. I cannot recommend it highly enough to your listeners. My wife and I have both read it numerous times. I think all parents should read it. I've read parts of The Anxious Generation, and I found it to be spectacular. He's at the leading edge of the research surrounding the corrosive impact of social media use and its strong correlation with anxiety, depression, and suicide. And the other thing we've done is bubble wrapped our kids and allowed them less time to do free play outside. And Jonathan Haidt has talked about that. Notably, in his interview this week on Joe Rogan's podcast, Jonathan Haidt endorsed our TikTok effort and talks about how TikTok is unusually malicious in terms of how addictive the algorithm is, as well as the national security concerns surrounding Chinese ownership. And so we're hoping to host Jonathan Haidt when he comes to D.C. next month. He's an indispensable voice on these issues. And to your point, Hugh, at a broader level, as I step back and get out of sort of the military aspects of this competition or the technological aspects of this competition, I don't know how we beat China over the long term if a whole generation of Americans are illiterate, if they can't read and they don't have attention spans. And we have to figure out a way to reduce this addiction to social media. It's why I've called it digital fentanyl. We have actual fentanyl that is destroying the lives of millions of Americans. And then we have digital fentanyl that is destroying the minds of an entire generation of Americans. And as for the boomers, Hugh, you guys broke everything, and my generation is trying to fix it.
All right, so we'll put that aside, but let's go back to this First Amendment issue. It will be a case of first impression. We do not know how the Supreme Court ruled. It is my opinion, it is perfectly legitimate and has been upheld before to control the means of production of media by foreign adversaries like the Chinese Communist Party. I don't think it'll be a close case. I think it'll be a 9-0 case. But let's bring the case. We can't bring the case until the bill passes. And if I see a senator not voting on this, I am going to guess it's a lobbying effort. I don't even know what 7 lobbying firms can do. What can they persuade people about? There is no discussion here. It's a disaster for the country to have TikTok.
Well, I think their primary lobbying tactic backfired. Their primary lobbying tactic was to push that notification to millions of their users requesting their zip code and then having them call their members of Congress. In some cases, you had kids with school bells going off in the background, threatening suicide, telling their members of Congress not to vote on this TikTok bill. I think that just proved the point about how this platform could be weaponized in order to interfere with the legislative process. And so that is why we got such a strong vote out of the House last week.
Well, good luck in getting the attention of your colleagues like Tom Cotton. And when you see your chief of staff today, tell him that the non-full disclosure about being ejected from Denison is weighing heavily on my mind. He could have easily said, well, I went to Wake Forest, but you know, it's just you got to investigate that. That might be an FBI deal. There might be something there. I'm just saying.
When he strolls in around 11:30 a.m.
If you get him there by noon, I think you're winning. I do. I thought it was very, very revealing about the culture of Congressman Gallagher's office. Thank you, Mike Gallagher. I'll be right back. America Station. Alliance Defending Freedom has got a Supreme Court argument next week. They win, typically, at the Supreme Court. They've won 15 times in the last two decades, 15 times. Takes about $1 million to win one of those cases. I just urge you, whether it's $5, $50, $500, Alliance Defending Freedom, it's completely tax deductible. They preserve your rights in a court, at least part of which is hostile to your First Amendment rights to free speech and the free exercise of your faith. So please support Alliance Defending Freedom. The banner is at HughHewitt.com. At the top, you cannot miss it. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined now by United States Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back.
Good morning, Hugh. Good to be on with you.
Thank you. I got a number of things to cover. First of all, I got to ask you, your successor in interest in the David Dreyer Memorial segment is Congressman Mike Gallagher. And turns out I went, middle of the day to the barbershop and I found his chief of staff there. I'm just wondering, does anyone go to work on time in the Hill? I mean, does anyone ever show up at like 9 and work till 5?
What I've noticed in my time there is no, they don't. 15-minute votes can take an hour and 15 minutes, and committee hearings don't start on time. I got to say, once you lose an ethic of punctuality, it slides rapidly and offends the sense of order for an old infantryman.
That brings me to my second question about your being an old infantryman. President Biden and Jake Sullivan have summoned Israelis to come and tell them how to secure the Egypt-Gaza border without, quote, smashing into Rafah. What do you think about that? Smashing into Rafah is just such a stupid way to put it, but that's what they said.
Well, obviously Israel can't destroy Hamas, can't kill or capture all of its leaders and fighters without going into Rafah. That's why not just Benjamin Netanyahu, but his war cabinet said they will. That's why it's the overwhelmingly popular position among the Israeli people. What Jake Sullivan and Joe Biden are doing, they're not trying to help an ally win, but they're trying to staunch losses in their own party. This is like Chuck Schumer's bizarre speech last week and deeply offensive call for new elections in Israel. As unprecedented as that is, the election that they're really worried about is not Israeli elections, it's American elections. They've let anti-Semitism fester in their ranks for years, and the American people are repulsed by it. And they're strongly pro-Israel. So you got Joe Biden and Jake Sullivan and Chuck Schumer doing everything they can to scramble, to try to avoid losing this election at a time when Israel is engaged in an existential war.
I agree with that. And so this brings me to the question about Chuck Schumer. Why is he tough on Israel and soft on TikTok? Because TikTok could be on a timeline to divestment from the CCP if Chuck Schumer would attach it to the appropriations bill. There's no indication that he will. So why is he hard on Israel and soft on TikTok?
Well, again, the first point goes back to his own electoral problems and the outbreak of anti-Semitism the American people have seen, from outlaws blocking traffic in major cities to vandalizing Jewish-owned businesses or protesting the entrances of hospitals. So Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden are hard on Israel because they think it's what is necessary to hold their very fragile coalition together. I'm not sure why Chuck Schumer won't move forward on the TikTok bill. I mean, I agree with Chuck Schumer before he flip-flopped. Just a few years ago, he himself called for TikTok to be divested from ByteDance, its Chinese communist-dominated parent company. I think we need to move forward promptly with the bill the House of Representatives passed with an overwhelming bipartisan majority. And I've been working with Chairman Gallagher and a lot of my colleagues in the Senate to try to get that done as soon as possible.
Now, I want to switch to politics, Senator. Bernie Moreno won the three-way primary. I was neutral in that. I know all three of them. They were all on the program the same amount of time. Turns out that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance have more sway in Ohio than Mike DeWine and Rob Portman. And that's fine. Ohio made up its mind, and Bernie won. Did you endorse in that race?
I did not endorse in the race. I met with and stayed in touch with all three candidates, all three good men. I look forward to working together now with Bernie Moreno and all Ohio Republicans to make sure that Bernie gets elected and we bring a sane Bernie into the United States Senate. who helps deliver us the Republican majority.
Yeah, I'm calling it the Bernie offset. We've just got to offset the other Bernie. But I have a question about Sherrod Brown. I know that members of the Senate have a rule about not speaking ill of each other. This is a factual question. Has he ever had a job in the private sector, to your knowledge? Because he got out of Yale, and I think he went right to the State House. I don't think he's not a lawyer. I don't think he ever worked a day in the private sector.
Not to my knowledge either, Hugh. If he did, it certainly didn't make a dent on his understanding about the most basics of market economics and what it's necessary to create prosperity in the country and to create new jobs, because he has been in government, if not his entire life, at least for the vast, vast majority of his life.
Well, he's older than I am, and he's been in government longer than I've been out of college. I really don't understand how people can possibly understand the state if they've been in the government that long.
My goodness, you older than you. That is,
I know. He's ancient. And he's like Joe Biden, the president. Let's talk about that. Did you go to the State of the Union, Senator? Did I ask you that last week?
I did attend the State of the Union. I thought I'd, for a moment, stumbled into a DNC convention speech. I didn't understand from the very first moment why Joe Biden was yelling at us. And I didn't imagine that it was going to play much better on TV than it did in the House chamber. And the polling we've seen since then proves that point, despite the Democrats' efforts to pick themselves up and pump themselves up and explain how Joe Biden is so strong and energetic. The polls since the State of the Union show it didn't make a dent because it didn't do anything to secure our border or bring down prices or make America more respected in the world.
What did you make about the straw man argument that he sent a border bill? Now, I know Jim Lankford, he's a fine senator. He did the best he could. There was no wall. There was no way. The wall is called table stakes on the show earlier today by Ron Johnson, which I'm stealing from him because the wall is table stakes for immigration reform. Did that work with anyone? Does anyone believe that nonsense that because Jim Lankford brought back the best the Democrats would give and it wasn't good enough that somehow the Republicans are responsible for this?
No, of course not, Hugh. This is a Biden-made disaster. Joe Biden is the one that campaigned on the promise to open our borders. That's exactly what he did on the first day. And that's what we've seen for the last 3+ years. I just returned from a trip to El Salvador, which, unlike the United States, has cracked down on violence and crime and is now one of the safest places in the Americas. But what I heard there is that many Salvadorans from the very beginning of the presidency, like people throughout Latin America and indeed across the world, began to make the very dangerous journey to America because Joe Biden told them they could get in. And that's the long and the short of it. And he doesn't need to send legislation to the Congress. He just needs to reverse his own disastrous policies. But what we really need to do is end his presidency and return Donald Trump to the White House if we want to secure the border.
Now, I've got to play for you back to back two Joe Biden quotes. One was from the El Porto restaurant in Phoenix yesterday. And the first one is from the Nevada appearance. He was in the swing states of Nevada and Arizona yesterday. Here's the president of Nevada, cut number 23.
And while I'm paying for it, we're also reducing the federal debt at the same time. You know, the Republicans talk about, big tax and Democrats. Give me a break. Come on. I've already cut the federal deficit by $1 trillion since I took office.
All right, so let's go to cut 21 earlier in the day in Phoenix, cut number 21.
And we've cut deficit by the time it's out, over $2 trillion.
Okay, now, Senator Cotton, which is it? Did he cut the deficit by $1 trillion or by $2
trillion? I don't know. It's confusing and confused is the way I would describe that. Obviously, Joe Biden hasn't cut the deficit. We've added trillions of more debt since Joe Biden took office. And I would remind all your listeners, that's at a time when we're coming out of a global pandemic and a national emergency. If anything, the deficit should have been falling from the moment Joe Biden took office. But rather, what they did is spend trillions of dollars we don't have to advance their ideological priorities, things that the American people don't want and don't need at a price that we can't afford. And that's why we have runaway inflation.
I've got to play for you one more cut of the president yesterday at the El Porto, because this one amuses me. Cut number 16.
When I get criticism some places for having such a strong interest in Latino voters and Latino Americans and people here in the country, I point out to them, I say, can you imagine when you have 28% of all the students in public school are Latino and nationwide?
Okay, Senator Cotton, Has Senator, has President Biden ever been criticized for having an interest? To your knowledge, I'm unaware of what he's referring to for being criticized and being interested in Latino Americans. Do you have any idea what he's talking about?
No, once again, confused and confusing. My concern is that Joe Biden doesn't seem to have an interest in the well-being and prosperity and safety of any Americans, Latino, Black, White, Asian, or anyone else.
Okay. Last question for you, Senator. There's a new story in Commentary Magazine by Dr. Christine Rosen over at AEI called The Elite War on the American Middle Class and How to End It. And it turns out the great surprise to me is that 25% of students who attend American so-called elite universities, and you and I are both alums of Harvard, and they used Harvard as an example on their podcast, 25% are foreigners, which is just fine. I mean, foreigners can go, but 25%? Do you think that such places ought to get federal subsidies if one out of four places is not open to an American applicant?
Well, I think that's much too high, Hugh. Again, it's one thing to have some international students to add that different kind of perspective to your student body. But to have one in four, again, and all it's doing is artificially suppressing the opportunities for American students to take those spots. It's also, I suspect, driven financially because almost all of those foreigners are the children of wealthy elites from those countries, and therefore they're paying full freight tuition, whereas, you know, kids from rural Arkansas or industrial towns in Ohio may be getting financial aid. But it seems to be much too high. But then again, since I wouldn't wish those schools today on my worst enemy's kids, maybe it's good that they've got so many foreign kids. Like,
oh, man. If you were American, I would go to the Ohio State University or the University of Arkansas before. I will have no influence on what my grandkids do. But honestly, I think they're hothouses of non-learning. I don't know what they do anymore.
No, I recently heard someone say that their kid had gotten into Princeton, and a third person looked at him and said, "I'm so sorry to hear that." because they are hothouses of indoctrination. And I talked to a tech CEO, major tech CEO of a highly respected and accomplished company, and he said that he simply doesn't recruit at Ivy League campuses anymore. He'd much sooner hire an engineer or a computer programmer from Ohio State or some other big flagship university like the University of Arkansas, because they're not indoctrinated. They're not coming into his company with a political agenda and expecting him and his company to cater to them. They're coming there because they want to do the work and they want to accomplish the mission, which in many cases supports law enforcement and our military, and they want to advance in their career.
The last thing, I want you to read this. It turns out the American military is overwhelmingly recruiting its enlisted people from the middle class, not from the lower class, not from the upper class. Does that surprise you?
No, Hugh, it's always been a falsehood that people who join the military do so because they're out of options. I mean, it is true, of course, that if you're very poor or you've had run-ins with the law, that the military and good order and discipline it provides helps turn your life around. But for the most part, the military recruits some of the very best kids we have in the country.
It's a fascinating article. I recommend it to you because I think it's quite the reveal on what's going on in the country. Senator Tom Cotton, follow him at Send Tom Cotton on X. Come right back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned. Folks, so many people I know are disheartened that our country seems to have forgotten the importance of citizenship. And they wonder how a strong sense of citizenship might be revived. That's why my friends at Hillsdale College have produced a free online course on the topic, American Citizenship and Its Decline. Taught by historian Victor Davis Hanson, the course traces the history of citizenship and explains how it is undermined in America today by open borders, by identity politics, by the administrative state, and by globalization. Americans taking the course will gain a deeper insight about the connection between citizenship and freedom, an insight they can share with family members, friends, and neighbors. Hillsdale's free online courses are an important component of Hillsdale's mission to reach and teach increasing millions of people on behalf of liberty and the American way of life. So sign up today for Hillsdale's free online course, American Citizenship and Its Decline, by visiting hughforhillsdale.com. That's HUGHFORHillsdale.com. hughforhillsdale.com. Start your free course today at hughforhillsdale.com. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is myphdweightloss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
You're tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Hewitt, nothing pre-recorded this morning. Not at all. I will not be here tomorrow. Ed Morrissey will be in for me. I got to fly down to Miami for one day, and I'll be back on Friday. I do want to call your attention, though. I am a big, big backer of the commentary podcast. I think the combination of John Bodhoretz, Abe Greenwald, Matt Continetti, Christine Rosen, and, of course, I'm not going to mention Seth Mandel because Bethany gets mad at me, but they have a great discussion of everything, all enemies foreign and domestic, and all good things, and commentary recommends. I'm reading The Three-Body Problem. It is my go-to podcast, along with the wonderful podcast from the Times of Israel, which come out pretty often, and with Getting Hammered. So I'm not, most of my other podcasts are just Cleveland Browns and Cleveland Cavaliers and Cleveland Indians and Buckeye Talk and things like that. Show me your podcast and I'll show you whether or not you're informed or not. And if you're not listening to, I mean, there are lots of good podcasts out there, I'm sure, including Highly Concentrated Hue, which you should be listening to every day. So yesterday I'm listening to the Commentary Pod and they tell me about a new article by Christine Rosen, The Elite War on the American Middle Class and How to End It. And this article is electric. I don't know Dr. Rosen. She works at the American Enterprise Institute. She is the commentary media columnist, and I don't know her. I've never met her. I don't think I've ever been inside of AEI, actually. Some people never leave AEI, as far as I can tell, but she's at AEI, and she is actually a scholar who produces a lot of material, unlike a lot of the AEI scholars that Arthur Brooks had to dump when he first got there. They weren't producing anything, but she actually produces a lot. And this story, The Elite War on the American Middle Class and How to End It, I think is a must read for understanding American politics. On the podcast, though not in the article, Christine Rosen said, I almost called it not the silent majority, the simmering majority. And I thought, too bad she didn't, because The Simmering Majority is a fabulous article and a fabulous title, because the great silent majority that Richard Nixon referred to in the 70s is now the great simmering majority in America. I think it's the 80% between the 10-yard lines, right? The American middle class is huge. And how one judges who is in the middle class and who is not in the middle class is a difficult and imprecise science, but it's huge. And it used to drive all of politics and all of culture. And the argument is made in this. Well, I'll just read you the first few graphs. Being middle class in America, writes Christine Rosen, used to mean something. Something socially transformative. Something even revolutionary. The American middle class represented a form of national social order never before seen on the earth. Cultural domination not by the very rich and the very educated, or the political domination either by tyrants or the mob, but by a mass of people relatively well-to-do who felt themselves fortunate in their circumstances. That was what made the American middle class different from the French or the English bourgeoisie. Its members believed, our middle class believed, that the country believed that they were the nation's backbone, its true governing class, and its moral compass. Throughout most of the 20th century, and I'm born in 1956, I'm 68 years old, this is all about my world, right, the middle class. Throughout most of the 20th century, the term middle class signaled membership in an optimistic and growing group, most of whom had risen within memory from physically laborious jobs in farming or on factory floors to offices and small businesses that ran themselves. This, by the way, is my dad, who grew up on a farm and did the chicken coop and managed to get into Oberlin on a football scholarship before he went off to World War II and came back and became a graduate of Oberlin and went to Michigan Law School and got a job and went from the middle class to the upper, to the upper middle class, not to the upper class, the upper middle class, the war in Ohio had a few people in the upper class, but not many. But the upper middle class is what I come from. And it comes from the middle class upbringing of my father and the working class upbringing of my mother, who was a nurse, didn't go to college, went to nursing school, and her father, my grandfather, was a fireman. So the whole deal about this article is what happened to the cultural power and the political power of the middle class. And what were the core convictions of the American middle class? Christine Rosen asked rhetorically. It valued its freedom and its autonomy, check. Was proudly patriotic, check. Involved itself in local communities, check, check, check. And was church-going without being fanatical about it, check. Its position at the dead center of American life was reflected in mass culture in ways that were both positively reinforcing and widespread. If you turned on any radio program in the 1930s or 40s, or any network television show before the advent of the cable era, you would likely find some benign portrait of the middle-class American nuclear family staring back at you. Providing that kind of mirroring comfort made cultural and financial sense in a country where approximately 61% of adults lived in middle-class households. All right, it's down to 44% in 2000. So the middle class, defined however economists define it, down to 44% in this century. But that's still a big market, and it's an enormous market for everybody who wants to skim the cream. All right, if you want to skim the cream, you've got to figure out a way to sell into the middle, and to sell into the middle with people with disposable income. And what Christine Rosen explains is that elite culture on the coast have basically abandoned that effort. Now, this radio show is aimed at the middle class. All right, it just is. People who are driving to work, right? I'm doing a morning drive show for people who are driving to work and who often work with their hands. I am no longer middle class. I am now the 1%. And that's because I'm 68 and I've never had less than three jobs. And I don't spend any money on clothes. That, you know, I don't care about any of that stuff. And neither does the fetching Mrs. Hewitt. So that's why we made the jump. But it requires savings and it requires education and it requires hard work. And it's the kind of stuff that doesn't happen. Now I find that politics generally is targeted at people in the, let's say, the 5%, because they donate, right? They donate money. And that's why, and that's also targeted to the lower class and the poor, because they vote in numbers not seen before in America. And this is an important demographic as well. What happened to the middle class? They saw doors shut on them in the last 20 years. And what the podcast brought through more than the article, and I recommend them both to you, is that it used to be the case. John Podhoretz, his grandparents were immigrants. His mom and dad were middle class intellectuals, but middle class. And I'm sure John is upper middle class now, if not lower upper class like me. I don't know. I don't really care. I do care if people are smart and if they're respectful of everyone. But I do believe that American culture fragmented with the arrival of cable and now, of course, internet availability of everything, so that everything is micro-targeting towards the super consumer, and people are tracked online and people are sold what they want to be sold, and they spend way too much time online and not enough time reading Commentary Magazine or listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show, playing a variety of clips and doing the news. They're more interested in being entertained. But what was really revealing, and I think it is a campaign issue, is that elite institutions in America, like Harvard — they brought up Harvard a lot yesterday. I'm not bringing up Harvard because I'm a Harvard guy. I rarely do. But I got into Harvard because they had an Ohio quota, and I scored really well on a standardized test. That's why I'm not a legacy, and I just got lucky. I got lucky that they needed someone from Warren, Ohio, and they needed someone who could score really well on standardized tests, which I could, because I took Latin forever and I was a reader. And that's, you know, I can do math, or at least I used to be able to do math. I don't do math anymore. I gave up on math as soon as I got to college. Said, that's done. Calculus, put it away. Forget it. Chemistry, done. Physics, barely made it out of physics. Not going to do that anymore. I'm going to take government, politics, and anything else that keeps me out of that. But that pathway, where you could come from the middle class and get to an elite institution on either coast was open, and now it's closed. And it's closed because American elite institutions cater to the very wealthy and to the poor. It's the DEI effect at the lower level, and an astonishing statistic I did not know. 25% of the student bodies at what are so-called American elite institutions are now foreign students who are paying full freight, and they're double counted. And I think when the Republicans take over Congress again, not only is the Department of Education going to reform, not only is affirmative action now unconstitutional, clearly so, there are going to be stipulations on American universities getting American money and how big the foreign student population can be. Not nativists, simply reflecting who built those places. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.